You're listening to The Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 21st of July, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 211th edition of The Monocle Weekly, with me, Sophie Grove, and Steve Bloomfield.
On the show today, we'll be heading to a Coptic monastery in the Egyptian desert to browse the shelves of one of the world's most ancient libraries.
We'll also head to Echo Spring and ask why a writer's seemingly predisposed to be imbibers of the hard stuff.
And they were the lost gems of Bollywood's golden age. We'll speak to the vocalists who rifled through Bollywood's musical archive and came up with this. The Bombay Royale will be with us in the studio later in the programme.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards will be here with some news for the week ahead, and of course we'll fit in some tunes too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Sophie Grove, hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Excelente.
It's been a lovely, another lovely sunny week here in London, hasn't it? It's almost got to the stage where people are starting to complain a bit about the weather because it's just too hot all the time.
As ever. I mean, actually, people have been a little bit reticent to start on the moaning route, considering it's so blissful.
It has. Have you managed to swim yet?
Yes, I have. Early morning dip.
Really?
This week. Although the Lido in East London is rammed.
Yeah, how early do you have to get there to put down your towel?
Well, it's quite complicated because there are waves. So there's the early birds before work. If you get in with that crowd, it's just, you know, they're really like fish swimming up and down. Then there's a little bit of a lull between 8 and 9, and that's when I slide in.
Okay.
But I've got a membership so I can breeze to the front of the queue that is snaking out of the Lido in East London. It's gone, you know, it's like a proper heat wave.
It is indeed. It is actually technically a heatwave. They said it was a heatwave. It's been funny actually watching the news here in the UK because we're so unused to the weather that the weather itself has been news. They've been interviewing people in the park saying, "What are you doing here in the park?" "Oh, we're sunbathing. Isn't it great?" "Yeah, it's great."
Top of the news today. I'm eating an ice cream. It's a bit of an excuse for people to talk relentlessly about the weather, which we're doing now.
We are.
But I do think that people should know how the British dress when it gets hot like this.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the dress code, because where do you stand on the shorts debate? We'll extend this debate when Tom Edwards comes in, because I know he has some very strong views on this. But I tend to think that shorts, for certain type of person, shouldn't be worn in the office, but I realise I'm in a minority in this office.
I mean, if you have astounding legs, men and women, you can get away with a lot. And I'm talking about a couple of members of staff who have, you know, really managed to pull off.
You're talking about Fernando Augusto Pacheco, aren't you, in particular?
He does. He really pulls off a short very well. But I mean, on the tube when you're coming to work, you see some shorts that probably should have been reconsidered when you were just putting that key in the latch, thinking, no. I think Londoners have just got more and more scantily clad as the week's gone on.
they have indeed. And quite when people decided it was okay to wear, you know, trunks and bikinis in parks, I don't know.
There was a man on the tube this morning with no top on and a rucksack. He was on
the
way to work. Well, it was 9 a.m.
Okay, well, that's reasonable. He's going to be here in a moment to give us some news from next week, and also to give us his views on office attire. I think it's going to be quite strict. Tom Edwards.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball, this is Tom Edwards with his weekly look ahead.
Tom, welcome to the studio. Lovely to see you.
Hi, Sophie. Hi, Steve. How are you both?
Very good. Lovely to see that you, like me, have chosen trousers to wear today.
That's correct. I did hear what you were saying. And for me, an office environment, even on a chilled out Sunday, requires, for the gentleman, a trouser.
And yet we are in a minority, aren't we, amongst the gentlemen of the office?
A small minority, but I will not be beaten simply by the majority of you, Steve. As you know, I'm very single-minded.
I have to say, I've been working on an etiquette guide for my entrepreneurs supplement, which is going to be completely sort of indispensable in business communities around the world, I'm sure. But shorts are a no-no in many cultures. Doing business, I mean, you're not going to seal a deal. Let's put it like that.
I wouldn't.
No. Well, there we are.
And that's why I'm wearing a full tweed three-piece, even though it's the needle's nudging 100 degrees.
I mean, I think that is slightly excessive. Yeah.
Well, I like to be smart, Steve.
Well, you do. You do like to be smart. We should have asked you for next week's weather as well as next week's news.
Sunny.
Really?
I'll go out on a limb.
Yeah, for Europe. For Europe, sunny. Should we have some news?
Yeah, well, what I was going to say, you know, it is Sunday. What are some of the classic things we enjoy on a Sunday? Leisurely coffee, perhaps?
Sunday roast, although not
Sunday
in this
roast,
weather.
A little warm, but Sunday papers. Everyone loves their Sunday papers. But there's reason in Australia today.
Oh,
for
yeah.
some people, maybe not to enjoy them quite so much. News Corp is increasing all of the prices of all of its Sunday titles by 50 cents today. Following Fairfax, who did the same for their Sydney flagship paper last week. And so now all across the board, all of our listeners in Australia will probably have harumphed at the counter this morning or, you know, raised an eyebrow when their papers arrived on their doorstep,
yeah.
if indeed they
so
have taken
So why
Sunday
such
delivery.
A steep hike?
Competition, Sophie, that's what it's all about. So, you know, News Corp say that they're responding and Fairfax, we know, have had some problems of their own. But I think it's a great shame because it's one of the, for me, Sunday religious service involves no churches. It's the papers.
It's the papers.
And you can't just suddenly put up the prices by 25%. I think it's an outrage.
Well, also, for Sunday papers, you can't read them on your laptop or your tablet or whatever. It can't be online. You've got to have the paper in front of you. You've got to be like, no, I'm going to have the sport now.
Exactly. Why not cut the price? Get even more people involved.
But you pay for what you get. I mean, they can't produce the paper of that quality. You know, these papers are huge on Sunday.
That's
a big
disappointingly
chunk.
Pragmatic economic answer from one of our business overlords. And that is indeed a very fair point.
Mm.
But I'm not going to. I will not rest.
Okay.
I think it's a shame. But anyway, my commiserations go out to our Australian listeners anyway.
Okay, there we are.
They'll never see that 50 cents again.
No, they won't. They won't. But maybe we'll keep some journalists in jobs.
Absolutely.
Who knows?
But
maybe it won't actually.
Yeah, no, it probably won't. To be honest, but
no, it won't. So for those people that decide that let's say you're in Australia and you're deciding you can't afford or you don't want to, you're outraged. You're not going to spend any more money on your news. Therefore. The only place they can get their news today is from you, Tom Edwards.
Absolutely.
Poor them. What else do you have for them?
They'll be pleased. That's a good source. Well, I think all their eyes, along with the eyes of everyone all around the world, will be on Brazil tomorrow. Pope Francis I is heading to Rio. Of course, he's Buenos Aires born. This is his first trip since he was confirmed in his new fairly important position. He's off to Brazil. Lots of interesting developments. Obviously, Brazil, huge Roman Catholic population, but quite divided, actually, because, you know, a lot of new evangelical churches are growing in strength. So it'll be interesting to see how he deals with that. Some small controversies. He's refused the offer of his bulletproof Pope Mobile, or who, as shorts aficionado Fernando Pacheco, our colleague, was referred to it apparently as Papa Mobile in Brazil.
I like it like that.
Exactly.
Papa Mobile.
It's kind of more, it's more avuncular or, well, paternal, in fact. Despite the security risks, he said that he wants to reach out and touch people and that they will be his protection.
I would like to see him in a Papa Copter. A nice
Papacopter.
Shot. A nice shot of the Papa Copter. By the big Jesus Christ the Redeemer statue.
Beautiful.
That would be a
you know
shot
what you've
there.
Done there, Steve?
Yeah.
You've painted a picture with words.
Because actually, I've just been in Italy and there's been quite a lot of chat about the new Pope Francis, you know, and the way he gets the bus. He hopped on the bus in Italy.
He's a man of the people.
And one man said to me, because we all know that the former Pope took a helicopter on his last journey. Mm. One man said to me, "Jesus didn't leave on a helicopter." So, absolutely not. And would he have done if he were here? No.
No. Jesus left in, yeah. I don't think Jesus really chose the circumstances in which he left.
And he probably wouldn't have got a bus either, but if he was around now, I think the bus would have been more his style than a helicopter. Absolutely.
Indeed.
And of course, there's a lot of helicopters in Brazil, so there'll be plenty of opportunities for Francis I to continue to show that he's one of the common men.
Indeed. Do you have one final little nugget of news for us? Things to expect for next week?
Yeah, why not? Well, there's one I just thought I'd mention very briefly, which is on Tuesday. Singapore is opening its overseas centre in partnership with ECOWAS in Accra, in Ghana, which I just thought was very interesting.
ECOWAS, as in the... I can remember this. Economic Community of West African States.
2 points to Bloomfield.
Yes.
I just thought that's quite an interesting development because we talk a lot about China and their involvement in politically, economically in Africa. And interesting that some other communities are sort of extending their tentacles out and trying to establish some trade relations. Very interesting stuff. And one final sporting thing, Steve and Sophie. I know we all look back fondly to 2012 and the Olympic Games.
Mm.
We can enjoy it again. It's the London Anniversary Games on Friday and Saturday.
Oh, yes.
And some of the big beasts are going to be back, including Usain Bolt. Let's be fair, one or two of his Jamaica teammates, but let's not dwell on that.
No.
They'll all be back in town on Friday and Saturday. So let's keep the Olympic spirit going for another year.
We can relive the glory of essentially the opening ceremony.
Absolutely.
I want Danny Boyle back. Danny Boyle and his NHS beds, and we'll be fine. Tom Edwards, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
It is home to the earliest known biblical manuscript, some of the oldest dated literary texts known to exist. But until this year, the library at El Surian Monastery, nestled in Egypt's Nitrian Desert, has led a nomadic existence.
Its collection spans a millennium and includes the earliest dated manuscript of the Gospels and the earliest known example of a Christian literary text. Those tasked with protecting this precious inventory are the Coptic monks, who are believed to have lived at the site since the 6th century.
But the unforgiving desert heat and little room to store the priceless collection, the manuscripts were once stored beneath the abbot's bed, have left the library in a somewhat precarious position.
Well, in May, a new permanent home for the library was inaugurated, complete with a reading room and two stories in which to preserve and protect the manuscripts. To discuss the significance of the new library, we're joined by the writer Martin Bailey, correspondent for the Art newspaper, who's visited the El Surian Monastery. Martin, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Let's start with painting a little picture of the El Surian Monastery. Where exactly in Egypt is it, and when was it first built?
Well, it is an amazing monastery. It's in on the edge of the desert between Alexandria and Cairo. And when you approach it from the desert, it's said to look like a ship. It's got a long wall that goes round it, which actually dates to the 10th century, so it's 1,000 years old. And then the towers of the churches come up above it. And it's been likened to Noah's Ark. It's a sort of, it's an amazing place to come across. It's been extremely isolated until 10 or 20 years ago. Mains electricity was installed about 10 years ago and telephone communication about 10 years ago. And until then, it was really like life in the Middle Ages. And there are now just over 100 monks, Coptic Christian monks there. So it is just an amazing place to visit.
And let's talk about what's there in terms of these incredible artefacts, some of them quite scattered around the world in this very turbulent history that we've seen in that region. But can you give us an insight into how important these manuscripts are and what they are?
Yes, it's only been realised in very recent years quite how important these manuscripts are. They're some of the earliest Christian manuscripts to survive anywhere. There's the earliest dated Christian manuscript, which dates from 411. That's 1600 years ago. And part of it was removed from the monastery in the 19th century and taken to London. One of the monks was plied with alcohol and then gave up most of the manuscript. But interestingly enough, a very important page of the manuscript turned up fairly recently at the monastery, and it was found buried in the rubble of a 9th century tower. And it had been there for almost 1,000 years. So there are these terribly important manuscripts. And until recently, they were kept in the wrong conditions for most of the 20th century. They were kept in a box in one of the monks' cells. and mice and rats did their bit and ate part of the parchment. They then built a proper library on the top floor of a modern building about 30 years ago. But there were real problems because the library on the top floor didn't have the right environmental conditions, and the temperature fluctuates enormously. It's very cold at night and very, very hot during the day. And the kitchen was on the ground floor, so that was all a fire risk. So what they've done now is to build a new purpose-built library, which nestles against the 10th century walls of the monastery. And the manuscripts are kept safe in the basement storage area with proper environmental conditions. And there are now facilities for scholars, international scholars and Egyptian scholars, to visit the library and examine the manuscripts in the proper environmental and security conditions. And this work was organised by the librarian, who is a monk called Father Bagul, in conjunction with a British charity, the Levantine Foundation. And the library opened this May.
And when we talk about, you know, libraries in North Africa that look after, you know, these remarkably old manuscripts and parchments, we tend to think of the pieces of work in Timbuktu.
Yes.
Are there any similarities between the two projects, both in Timbuktu and here at El Surian, to try and look after these manuscripts properly?
Well, I suppose they are parallel cases. I mean, both countries have their political problems and Islamic fundamentalists, and it's obviously vital to preserve the manuscripts, to digitise them and to look after them. But of course, there are many differences in the situations as well. But I think that's an interesting example, and it shows the vulnerability of these ancient manuscripts. Here at El Surian, the monastery has done what is responsible and provide the best possible conditions for these precious manuscripts.
And it's quite interesting to look at where they came from. And it looks like some of the manuscripts were picked up on a trip to Baghdad in AD 927, which gives you an insight into the early Christian manuscripts of that era and the incredible communication between places like Baghdad and elsewhere. Does this really throw a light on early Christianity that's very important for historians?
Yes, I mean, there is much more communication, as you say, than one might have thought. And what's quite interesting about the collection at El Surian is that some of the manuscripts are in Syriac, some are in Arabic, some are in Ethiopian writing, and other languages. So it's a very cosmopolitan collection of manuscripts, which is really the heritage of certainly the entire Christian world, and in a sense, really the whole world.
And I guess one of the most exciting things about this is that we still don't know entirely what these manuscripts contain yet, do we? Because a lot of it hasn't actually been catalogued properly yet. I mean, there's a process going on at the moment.
Yes, no, you're quite right. I mean, the catalogue is going on and discoveries are being made along the way. And until 10 years ago, or so ago, scholars had very, very little idea of what was there. There are just over 1,000 complete early manuscripts and several thousand fragments. Many of them are difficult to read. Many of them need conservation in order to be handled and in order to be read. So I'm sure that many more discoveries will be made along the way.
And in terms of the building itself and what this means for the Coptic Christians in Egypt, who've had really a tough time over the last couple of years, certainly. Do you think that this is really significant for them to have such an important centre of learning now at the monastery?
Yes. I mean, the library project was started several years ago before the present political uncertainties came up. But since the fall of Mubarak, the Coptic community has felt under pressure, and there has been, particularly from Islamic fundamentalists. So it's obviously important for them to preserve and look after their heritage. I mean, they're just a small monastery in the desert, so They're not doing any harm to anyone, but it is very important that their treasures are protected against political uncertainties, events and protests.
And in terms of other projects like this around the world, is there, I mean, obviously we talked about Timbuktu, but is there anything else comparable anywhere else where you think something like this is perhaps necessary, or there are talks about having similar sorts of processes?
Well, an interesting example is Ethiopia, to the south in Africa, in eastern Africa, where again there are very important manuscripts which are only now being discovered, and some of the earliest Christian manuscripts to survive anywhere are in Ethiopia. And there is a project not to build an entire library, but to conserve the manuscripts in Ethiopia.
Martin Bailey, we'll leave it there. Martin Bailey from the Art Newspaper, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to have some music now, and to whet your appetite for later in the programme, before we meet them in the flesh, let's hear it from the Bombay Royale. This is Mahindra Death Ride. And that was Mahindra Death Ride by the Bombay Royale. And we'll be face to face with the band's lead vocalists a little later in the programme. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
If design is your beat, then tune into Section D, our weekly show delving deep into the latest developments in the worlds of architecture, fashion, furniture, product development, tech, and many more.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
No matter what the sphere, we'll be here with expert insights, news, and exclusive interviews on all things design. So switch on to Section D every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Sophie Grove, and Steve Bloomfield. Well, it's the end of another week, so you might be forgiven for having a little drop of the hard stuff. some Dutch courage, if you like, for the week about to begin.
And it's fair to say that writers, journalists too, have a pretty rich history of having a bottle nearby as they put pen to paper. Ernest Hemingway, the rumour has it, drank his way back to the United States on a slow boat, having had his heart broken by an English nurse. And the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas famously drank himself to death at the White Horse Tavern in New York City back in 1953, while celebrating the triumphant reception of his latest collection of poems.
Well, the writer Olivia Lang took it upon herself to look at the relationship between liquor and the literary set and set off on a trip across the United States, tracing some of the country's greatest writers to ask why many of them battled with alcohol addiction whilst writing their greatest works.
And I'm pleased to say that Olivia Lang, the author of The Trip to Echo Spring, Why Writers Drink, joins us now in the studio. Olivia Lang, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hi.
Now, when we talk about writers and alcohol, there tends to be, everyone sort of smiles and go, yeah, writers drink. And in fact, in the office before we started this, when this book was first mentioned, everyone sort of laughed and was like, oh yeah, writing and drinking, I'm sure Stephen Sofe, they'll be able to talk about that. And yet there's obviously a really deeply serious side to this, isn't there, that kind of often gets masked by the lightness in the way that we try and talk about it.
Absolutely. I mean, I had the idea for this book quite a while ago, so I knew what I was going to do after I'd written To the Riff, which was my first one about Virginia Woolf and Virginia Woolf's suicide. So the joke was always, you know, you're going to have a great time after you've written that depressing book. And I used to work on a newspaper and, you know, everyone drinks very hard. So we were all like, yeah, great stories. It's going to be lovely. You can drink in lots of bars. And then I started reading the material and it starts off sort of intoxicating and glamorous and it just ploughs downhill. So some of the stories became incredibly dark, particularly Ernest Hemingway, John Berryman, both of whom committed suicide. But the sort of struggles, the car crashes people would make of their lives was just very sobering, I suppose is the right word.
Nate, you focus on six writers, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Hemingway mentioned, Tennessee Williams, John Berryman, John Cheever, Raymond Carver. Six men. Was that deliberate?
It was deliberate. I mean, this is a question that I've been getting asked a lot. Why didn't I write about women? And there are no shortage of women writers with drinking problems. Elizabeth Bishop, Jean Rhys, Marguerite Duras, who I absolutely love. I wanted to have people with enough sort of commonality of experience that it made a whole story. I think that was really important to me. I wanted... There's a lot of patterns between that six. Some of them knew each other. Some of them were friends. Some of them fell out because of their drinking. The other reason, which is slightly trickier, is that I grew up in a household with a female alcoholic and it just felt too close to home. It felt too personal. So I think very early on I realised that those just weren't stories for me. I'm sure someone else will write about them at some point.
Now, there are alcoholics and it really is interesting that you've looked at the relationship between drinking and creativity. These people are very productive. Do you think that alcohol did fuel any of that creativity at any point?
I really don't think it did. And that's one of the myths that I started off, you know, is this true or not? This is certainly something that people say. I think what it does, at least in the early stages, you get people like Hemingway talking about after a day's writing, it changes the channel. It lets you let go. You're in this sort of hyped up, pent up state. And it just lets that all fall away so that you can, as if you're running a marathon, you can pause, regroup, get back to it the next day. And then the other thing is that it can just alleviate the sort of social anxiety and intense shyness that a lot of the writers that I was writing about suffered from. So that really you see with Tennessee Williams, John Cheever, almost Berryman in a way as well. So it sort of made their lives possible, their creative lives, their social lives possible. So it's a more complicated relationship, I think, than we initially expect.
Do we... When you look at sort of why we mythologise people's writers drinking, is that because why is it? Is it because it sounds exciting, the fact that, you know, oh, these guys, they were drinking all the time and they wrote this amazing stuff, or is it something deeper than that?
I think part of it is it just looks so glamorous. You know, you have all those fabulous photos of Hemingway and Fitzgerald in these bars and they're drinking beautiful drinks like those daiquiris. You know, it's very sexy. What you don't see necessarily is the price that they're paying later, because these are over entire lifetimes, entire careers. I think we tend to sort of pick on, oh, Fitzgerald, the Great Gatsby, And that's the moment that we choose to freeze. And yet what happens later is not a pretty picture. And I think if we were looking at what happens later, we probably would have lost that glamorous idea quite a long time ago.
And in terms of the characters, for instance, John Cheever, he's such an intriguing person. And you talk about The Swimmer as being this incredible poem, a journey of this very troubled man. Do you think that really his character was inspired by all of those sort of fights with alcohol and that internal lifelong fight with alcoholism?
Yeah, and he's so interesting because he was an astonishingly creative man. He wrote hundreds of really incredible stories, but you do see as he sort of hits the 60s that they start becoming, and his work's always fragmented, it's always very interestingly fragmented, but it just starts pulling apart. It becomes something that's just, he can no longer hold a story together.
And the same with Tennessee Williams as well.
The same with Tennessee Williams, yeah, who's just, who I think was the one that I loved the most, but really completely loses that capacity. Completely loses that capacity for holding something together. But the interesting thing with Cheever is that he stops drinking. He manages to stop, which is really quite rare. And then he writes this novel called Faulkner, which is very much, it's about a man in prison who's struggling with heroin addiction. But it's very much about his escape from alcohol. And I really think it's his, it's kind of underrated, but I think it's his best novel. And it very much contains that whole struggle.
Now, the book's called The Trip to Echo Spring, and that echoes, if I can say that. Yeah, the trip that you actually took yourself to Echo Spring, the idea was to cross America going to certain points, be that in Miami or New Orleans or out west, that helped tell the story of these six writers. And at the start you said you began thinking, oh yes, writers and drinking, I'm sure they'll be quite lighthearted. At what stages through that journey did you start to realise that this was actually quite a dark tale you were trying to tell?
I think I had the sense of it before I actually started travelling. I'd done a lot of reading before, and part of the, it wasn't initially planned as a book that was going to have a journey element, and I started to realise that the material was so dark and so troubling and so potentially depressing that it really needed to be sort of physically held in a place. And so what I wanted to do with that was to kind of use those places as ways of exploring the things that had happened within them, but also to kind of almost offer some light relief, to offer some sort of uplift. And I think because all of them as writers, possibly excluding Tennessee Williams, but basically all of them were very sensitive to landscape, loved landscape and wrote about landscape exquisitely. And I think that it was really a way of showing consistently through the book what's best about their lives, what was most admirable, while also telling these stories of what they did that was most shameful. And that felt very important to be able to do both.
And you mentioned they were connected. I wondered how that unraveled and how they really did sort of drink together and interact together, how their stories crossed.
That, yeah, there are some amazing stories. So the two who knew each other best were obviously Hemingway and Fitzgerald, which is a story that's been told time over time. And you really see them becoming friends through being drinking buddies and their friendship souring so badly through their mutual alcoholisms. Hemingway couldn't stand that Fitzgerald couldn't hold his drink, and yet within a decade neither could Hemingway. It's really quite a tragic story. But then there's Cheever and Carver, who developed this very interesting friendship where they were both at Iowa University at the kind of famous writer's workshop for a year, and at that point Cheever was very famous. He was kind of the grand professor, and Carver was sort of a new upcoming writer, and they met, I think, on their first day there. Cheever came and knocked on the door, and, you know, Carver opens it going, oh my God, it's John Cheever. And John Cheever just looks at him and says, is there anything to drink in here? And that's it. They just lock onto each other. They immediately know that they both have the same need. And they say, Carver says afterwards, you know, that year, neither of us ever took the covers off our typewriters. That was what we did. We drank.
Does it make you rather sad thinking of all the great works that these guys could have possibly done if they hadn't actually been drinking so much?
I suppose so, but then at the same time, I wonder whether anything they wrote would have been the same if they hadn't been struggling with the things they were struggling with. I don't know if we would have something like A Farewell to Arms or, you know, all of these magnificent books that I don't want to say came out of that suffering, because I think that's not quite how it works, but it's complicated. It comes out of those complicated conditions. So I think no, I wouldn't change it.
And when we look at where we are now, I mean, obviously, this is historical. We're looking at writers, from the 20s through to the 60s and 70s. But I mean, even now, we kind of glorify the writers that drink. When Christopher Hitchens died last year, everyone talked about his famous drinking with Martin Amis, and wasn't it fun? And look at his these amazing stories they tell. Do you think attitudes have changed at all, though?
I think they have so much, because that's one of the things that slowly started striking me, is that, and you see this when you watch Mad Men as well, that era that I was writing about most, people are drinking all the time. People are drinking at lunchtime in offices. And I came into journalism at the very tail end of that. I remember we would go to the pub at lunchtime, and then I remember that changing, and there coming a point where nobody in the office would come in having had a drink. And we're much more aware of what alcoholism is, but we're also much more kind of careful, I think. So in a way, that's good, that it doesn't, we're not so permissive about it. And in a way, I suppose I slightly regret wild days.
And in terms of some of the works and this idea of, the addict in the novel or in a story, do you think that, I mean, it is such fodder for writers, and we're looking at this excruciating relationship in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, where this deterioration through alcohol, I mean, do you look at that in the book as a sort of a literary device?
That's the thing that was so fascinating to me, and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is the perfect example, that somebody can make art out of their own disease. The portrayal of Brick, the alcoholic son in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, is incredibly accurate, unstinting, courageous. And at the same time, when you read Tennessee Williams' diaries, he's an absolute mess. It's impossible to imagine. And it's a disease that's so much about denial that makes it particularly extraordinary to me that somebody can be in such denial about their own illness and yet capable of getting that down on the page.
And then the same with John Cheever with The Swimmer, which we mentioned before, a short story that he wrote in the 60s that it describes perfectly the way that alcohol can ruin someone's life, and it didn't really prevent him doing the same to his own life.
No, so it's that odd knowing and not knowing at the same time, which is what I really found so fascinating about them.
Has this changed your own attitude towards alcohol?
I'm sure this is a question.
Wine with lunch.
I'll get that a lot. I mean, I think there's a big difference between drinkers and alcoholics, and I have always drunk and enjoyed drinking and have never felt like I'm crossing that line. It's so much about families, genetic inheritance, all those things. So I suppose there are certainly some friends who say they don't want to read it. They're too scared. But I think I'm okay.
Okay, that's a good moment to leave it. Olivia Lang, thank you very much for joining us. The book is The Trip to Echo Spring, Why Writers Drink. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and onto Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
Now, what do you get if you put a group of Melbourne's bright young things in a room with some forgotten gems of Bollywood's golden era? Well, probably something that sounds a little bit like this.
The Bombay Royale there, which we gave you a taste of a little earlier on. They're a 10-piece Melbourne-based outfit founded a couple of years ago as an antidote, they say, to the wares being peddled in the melting pot that is Melbourne's music scene.
The result is the reimagining of some of the forgotten gems of Bollywood, mixing them with some Tarantino-esque surf, with the faintest whiff of disco, all anchored in an upbeat nostalgia for the heyday of Indian cinema.
Well, I'm delighted to say that the lead vocalist of the Bombay Royale join us now in the studio, Shourav Bhattacharya, a.k.a. The Tiger, and Parvin Singh, otherwise known as The Mysterious Lady. Thank you both for joining us here on Monocle 24.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Steve.
That's quite all right. So let's start with the obvious question first. Why Bollywood? Why Bollywood? And why change? What works pretty well?
Why not?
Yeah, well, I don't know if we really need a reason to do anything with art. You can just do it and not really worry too much about the reasons for it. If you like something, just kind of go on that flow. So that's where we came up with what we do. And then we've just created a sound which has spoken to us and that we enjoy listening to and that we enjoy dancing to and singing to on stage. And that's how it's all come to be, for sure.
Yeah, it's different, what we do, to contemporary Bollywood as well. So we're bringing back that retro sound. And that's not something that's really being done.
Maybe you could give an insight into one of your shows. I know our producer, Tom, went earlier this week to see you and came back raving. he loved it, but it's very intense. Lots of different sort of senses and technology in there, this kind of riotous atmosphere, and there are 12 of you. Give us an insight into one of your gigs.
Well, it all is quite dramatic. The way that the scene sets up is we get the musicians out on stage first and they set up kind of a really heavy groove, and we have screens at the back which are showing different images of us having a good time, really, but then with different visual effects and old school Bollywood films which are kind of mixed into the new style. So there's that visual aspect of the screen, and then the colour on the stage, and just the way that we look as a band is quite interesting, because all of the guys in the band wear bandit masks, for example. Like, so it's really much a story where they're a group of dacoits or dakus, which are the bad guys, and they have a gang leader who's the skipper, and he wears a full skipper's admiral outfit, which is the big white regalia type thing, and so he's conducting the whole kind of show. And then Shourav and I come out one by one to introduce our characters, and I'm the mysterious lady and Shourav's the tiger, and we're kind of like the secret agents that are infiltrating the skipper's band of dacoits. And then, you know, we have different things like a huge blow-up elephant that comes out halfway through the show sometimes, but for this show, we actually had him suspended from the ceiling. So as soon as you walk into the room, you're kind of just like, there's a massive elephant on
the ceiling.
There's literally
an elephant in the middle of the room.
There's an elephant in the middle of the room. So straight away, you're expecting something that's a little bit different.
Yeah.
And then the music is so vibrant. It's really colourful, and you've got to just get up and dance to it.
Do you ever mention the elephant in the room?
Occasionally, yeah. Yeah, we do. Yeah, I mean, it's about setting up a fantasy world, basically, and inviting people into that world with us. And so that's the whole vibe. We sort of enjoy that the audience is generally, you know, caught off guard a little bit. I mean, it's supposed to be different. It's not what you expect.
Yeah. And sure, the Bollywood music that you're inspired by, is it tends to be that from the 60s and the 70s.
That's right.
What is it about that era of Bollywood that particularly draws you in?
I think it's just the the inventiveness of it. It was just such a fertile time in Indian cinema. There were great directors, and there was just a clique of really great directors, R.D. Burman and Sapan Jagmohan and a bunch of other great names. There were fantastic playback singers, as they're called in India, Lata Mangeshkar and Ruffy and so on. And so there was just this confluence of really creative people in that industry who were taking influences from all around the world, Indian classical, folk music, but then also, you know, jazz and pop and surf music and everything else, and creating something new. And we love that. And so that's why the music, you know, is so great.
And give us an insight into how you all met and formed the group, because you're from Melbourne, but you definitely created something very new, this hybrid idea. How did it all come about?
Well, it actually started, Andy Williamson is the skipper of the band that I mentioned earlier, and he's a collector of old records and has a great Bollywood collection from the 60s. And we actually started out doing covers He sat down and he wrote out the scores for a lot of those great tunes like Dumbarodum and Jan Pechanho, which are the classics of that era, and got a bunch of friends together that he liked spending time with, and we just started jamming on them, and then it kind of grew from there. So we definitely started out as the basic and really cemented our roots in that style, because we were doing covers from that era. And then once we released a new album, it's when we started composing our own songs. And Shaurav does a lot of the songwriting in Bengali and Hindi, and there's an English track in there too. So that's, yeah, it was just the Bollywood covers that we love to listen to. And then obviously, I guess, because we are musicians that, well, the drummer and the guitarist are very much into that sort of funk style. We've brought it that, given it that edge, so it's a little bit more catchy in that way.
Now, Bollywood's become far more mainstream in the past, you know, few years, certainly in the past decade, whether that's, you know, Hollywood films or just more popularity all around the world. Do you think that in a way it's, you know, perhaps slightly lost its soul, or what the real reasons were behind it when it was so strong before?
It's a personal thing. I think some of us, yeah, do feel that way a little bit. I think a lot of us in the band especially, we love a lot of this, you know, the old sounds a little bit more than some of the new sounds. Some of the contemporary stuff is great too, of course. But, yeah, I mean, when any industry becomes bigger and it commercializes, then, you know, inevitably there's changes. I think really, you know, to me it feels like there was just some really, you know, genius composers and musicians around in that era. And you don't always get, you know, that many great minds together. It's just a bit of a random thing. It comes and goes.
And as the Bollywood movies go as well, like, I much prefer watching the old Bollywood movies compared to the ones that you have now. They're kind of a little bit sort of, that's the story and that's the girl and that's the guy, and it's very much the same sometimes. And I do like the new Bollywood films once in a while, but I guess even like the actors and the dancers especially, they were all very much trained in the classical form of art, and that then got crossed into the pop scene, whereas now I feel like, you know, it's a little bit more shake your booty, wear not so many clothes type thing.
It's almost been influenced too much by Western music,
yeah,
and Western culture.
Yeah, by the R&B and the American style of that hip-hop-y type thing, which has lost some of the beauty of, you know, the saris and the elegance of that really culturally specific Indian-style stuff, which I find just beautiful.
And do you find that, you know, there's a lot of awareness about that era, or are you bringing this to a kind of a relatively new audience? Is this something of a kind of mission to bring people's attention, certainly in London and or even in Melbourne, to this golden age?
Oh, definitely. We're definitely bringing people back. And it's the sort of thing that a lot of people of our generation would have listened to while growing up. Our parents listened to this style of music. That's what they were into. And so there is that familiarity with it. And this is kind of just a fresh taste that, hey, this stuff is really cool. Remember this stuff? That this is our part of our culture, and it's so unique and it sounds so great that we can revive it.
And sure, you've been touring this now for a little bit. You're going to Denmark and Sweden after your trip to the UK. Is there anywhere in particular where you feel that you've made a real connection in a place where perhaps you thought they might not get it?
Well, we just came from Europe too. We were in Belgium and we played a show in Germany and got great response there as well. And for, I think, you know, as you say, the audiences there really didn't know anything about the background to what we do. But yeah, they got it. And we toured some of the areas around Antwerp in
Antwerp
in Belgium.
That's the one. Yeah,
that's the one. Yeah,
they all kind of mix into one place. But
haven't come on stage yet. Yeah. So Franz said, "Hello, Bruce." And actually, you're in Antwerp.
Wherever so we've gone, they've had this great response to it because they haven't really expected anything. And so we've been surprised the whole way through. Even the show here in London, I was surprised by it because I thought that there is quite a big scene of Indian music. That Southeast Asian kind of community is very big, and so I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah, so an audience here is you know, fully aware of, or a lot of people will be fully aware of Bollywood.
Yeah, but they still surprised me. They really did. The audience just really got it, and they really dug it, and they were right there with us. So I'm very, very happy with how it's all gone so far.
And I wanted to just ask you about your new EP as well, because it's on vinyl. Which for you, as people who've listened to it, when you first started listening to Bollywood, it was on vinyl.
Yeah.
How important is that to have your own
bit of
Bollywood vinyl?
Yeah, yeah, it's great. I mean, the vinyl thing, just that feeling of getting it out and putting it on a player.
Yeah.
I love it. It's
and
great.
The whole aesthetic with vinyl too, and the artwork of the record cover. So we released our first debut album in vinyl too, and that was always something that our record company... Hope Street Records, that's kind of why we signed on with them, because that was where we wanted to go. We wanted to bring back to the vinyl, and yeah, it's such a coup.
Also, I mean, it's interesting that you're Australian musicians and you're shedding a bit of a different light on the Melbourne scene. In some ways, people have this kind of indie view of how the Melbourne music scene might look, but it's really a different element and kind of quite a brilliant window into what's going on in Melbourne. And we're often writing about the quality of life there and the scene, but it's quite interesting to see that kind of network that you've created.
Absolutely. I've always thought that a project like this would not have got off the ground unless it was a place like Melbourne. It's a unique scene. There's just a critical mass of great musicians in all different styles and in, from different parts of the world. And something like the Bombay Royale would not have worked in a scene which is not as diverse. So I think it's a, you know, really great advertisement, I suppose, for what we love about Melbourne and the Melbourne music scene.
Well, Shourav Bhattacharya and Parvin Singh, otherwise known as the Tiger and the Mysterious Lady, thank you both very much for coming. The Bombay Royale are touring throughout Europe, and I'm sure you can find them online as well. So that's pretty much it, isn't it, Sophie?
It is. It was fun.
It was.
I enjoyed it.
And you became very firm friends with Olivia Lang while we were while we were listening to a bit of music earlier. You and her, you were telling her all the places in Cambridge she should be going to.
Well, she says she divides her time between Cambridge and New York,
which are two cities. Which I mean, if you go and divide your time between any cities, that's not bad. It's not a bad mix, is it?
Exactly. And her last book was actually about the River Ouse. She mentioned it. Mm. It's rather sadly about
Virginia Woolf.
Exactly. Yeah. Who drowned in the ooze, but she's a swimmer. And I think she should find out about the little secret swimming club that there is in Cambridge now she's moved there.
Is it so secret that you can't share the secret on air?
Well, it's a club and you have to go down a beautiful little path, a secret path, and then you get to a green door and you have to have a key. You have to be a member.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's the Riverbank Club. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's like a bucolic, idyllic little garden next to the river. You can swim and have picnic and things. So she should join that, definitely. Yeah, yeah. I've got some good suggestions, but I know she's already swimming in the Lido.
Yes.
Jesus Green.
That's
beautiful.
The one that's 100 yards long.
100 yards long, built in something like 1919. Absolutely original, beautiful place, a sun trap.
There we are. You weren't expecting that from Michael Weekly, were you, as well? Some swimming tips there from Sophie Grove.
Well, that is all for edition 211 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. We'll be here again next week at the same time, so do join us then. But until then, it's goodbye from me, Sophie Grove.
And from me, Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.